Welcome to The Next Track, a podcast about how people listen to music today. I'm Doug Adams.
And I'm Kirk McElhern.
We self-produce The Next Track podcast and want to keep it ad-free, so we rely on contributions from listeners for support. You can help us by making a regular donation via Patreon. Visit patreon.com/thenexttrack. And thanks.
Before we get to our main topic, I want to discuss, I guess it was an interview that came out over the weekend in Billboard, that Billie Eilish was criticizing artists for releasing multiple versions of vinyl albums. And it's kind of interesting because she's released multiple versions of vinyl albums, but she claims that they're all made from recycled vinyl. So her issue is the environmental issue about the petrochemicals used to make vinyl, but also the transportation that makes it, you know, not very environmentally friendly. They talked about it on the news just this afternoon on the BBC News, and they had someone who was talking about, well, the vinyl revival and here's statistics, et cetera. And there's some artists who have done multiple versions, such as the Rolling Stones, who had how many versions of Hackney Diamonds, their album? Do you know?
Got to be like 28, 29.
43 different versions.
It's crazy.
I think they were related to football teams, so people would buy the one with their team, but most people wouldn't buy all 43. I'm sure there are some people who would buy all 43 to
collectionitis,
you know, to sell them later. Taylor Swift is releasing 4 vinyl versions of her new album sometime later this year. And you know, it's interesting, later this year, because they can't get them pressed fast enough.
I was reading about that because Beyonce just released
Cowboy Carter.
And they're talking about, how did you get this thing pressed so fast? Because they don't know how she did it.
Yeah. Speaking of Beyonce, fans are apparently upset. Miffed is what I read in The Guardian, that 5 songs from the album are not on the vinyl or CD versions.
Well.
Now, my first thought was, it must be a single LP, but it's got to be a double because I looked it up. It's 79 minutes, the whole album online. Got to be a double vinyl. So why are there not 5 songs? Is this a conspiracy? Could it have something to do with rights? Could it be the deep state that's doing this? I don't know.
It's the marketing team doing a great job getting people to talk about the record. You know, you got to admit that.
Oh, well, are they talking about the record or maybe not in the way they should? What I noticed is when I looked on Wikipedia at the list of tracks, it's like some of these tracks have 10 people listed as writers. There, she covers Blackbird, and that's just Lennon McCartney, and she covers Jolene, and that's just Dolly Parton. But most of the others have like a whole bunch of different people. So maybe the ones that aren't included, I'm not sure, but it could be for some reason questions of rights or who produced them or who knows. But the whole vinyl thing is interesting because they had someone on the BBC, someone, I believe, deputy music editor for The Guardian. Not once did this person say, yet 50% of people never play these vinyl records. They just buy them as merch or to put them on the wall.
How many do they actually sell? I mean, I believe,
if I'm not mistaken, the number that this woman said was 5.2 million in the UK last year. More than CDs.
Okay.
So it's quite a large number.
It's tough to know, though, because I remember when an artist would sell millions over the summer. So I'm having a tough time trying to figure out. I've always had a tough time trying to figure out what constitutes big sales nowadays. And still, 5 million doesn't really tell me anything at all.
I think most artists are selling in the tens of thousands. Now, indie artists might sell more because people buy them to support the band. They buy them like merch. They don't buy it like music. I think for these bigger artists, they're still limited because they can't get enough pressed. So they're going to sell 50 or 100,000 or maybe a couple 100,000, but not much more than that.
So even if they could get them pressed faster and quicker and in more quantities, you still don't think that they would sell more than they're selling now?
They might sell a little. There might be a long tail. But my guess is that if you look at certain types of books, art books and photo books, publisher makes a printing of X copies because it costs so much to set up a printing for something like that. And then they generally don't reissue it. They don't do a reprint. So that means in the secondary market, things have value. And it could be like that for vinyl. Since there's such a lead time to get records, not like in the past, maybe they'll do 50,000 Taylor Swift, but then there won't be any more because, well, it's too much of a hassle to wait 6 months for more, and will people buy them? We don't want to have this inventory. And
well, it's, I think it's unfortunate. I mean, just really quickly, I think it's really unfortunate that the vinyl has become this kind of thing. And you know, I think CDs are better quality. I think there's ways to stream better quality. The idea that it's merch, that's cute, but that's not why I would buy a record.
Album art.
Yeah.
Album art. And the best records have the lyrics printed on them.
Yeah. Yep. All of that stuff is all available everywhere, anytime, anywhere, anytime.
Notice that segue.
Yes. Oh, I see. Right. Lyrics. Because we're going to get into our main topic after 5 minutes of this.
So I spotted an article last week in The Guardian that links to an article in Nature entitled Song Lyrics Have Become Simpler and More Repetitive Over the Last Five Decades. Five decades from 1980 to 2020. They didn't look at like Louie Louie or Swamp Thing.
No. No, they didn't go back. They didn't go back to the 50s or the 40s or the 60s. They started in 1980, but that's okay.
It is.
It's a scientific study. It's a perfectly, their conclusions are perfectly valid, and their theories are very interesting.
The abstract of the article points out that we find that pop music lyrics have become simpler and easier to comprehend over time. Not only does the lexical complexity of lyrics decrease, for instance, captured by vocabulary richness or readability of lyrics, but we also observe that the structural complexity, for instance, the repetitiveness of lyrics, has decreased. In addition, we confirm previous analyses showing that the emotion described by lyrics has become more negative and that lyrics have become more personal over the last five decades. Finally, a comparison of lyrics, view counts, and listening counts shows that when it comes to the listener's interest in lyrics, for instance, rock fans mostly enjoy lyrics from older songs. Country fans are more interested in new songs' lyrics. Now, that's something I find interesting. I understand that rock fans may look at lyrics from older songs because, well, there's more older rock songs that are played, and you don't really care about the lyrics for the new songs. But that country fans are interested in new songs' lyrics. Maybe they're harder to understand, so people have to look them up?
I don't know. I thought that finding was kind of odd. I couldn't figure it out either. That's a strange dichotomy. So comparing how people listen to one kind of music and then comparing how they listen to another. I mean, I'm a person who listens to both of those kinds of music. I might be looking up newer country music. I think what it kind of suggested to me is something that Tom Petty said not long ago. He said country music is the new rock music. And what he meant by that is that men 25 to 54 are no longer listening to what's known as rock music, but they're switching over to country music because it has more of a, well, it has more of that what rock used to sound like. Whereas rock now, I think a lot of people would say is kind of wussy sounding. It's squishy, which is fine with me. I don't have a problem with that. But some fellas, you know, they prefer, they like their rock and they like their country music that's a little more, has a little more, more manliness, for lack of anything else. And there isn't a lot of that in a lot of current rock. This is part of the whole thing that they probably talk about in the Nature article. I had to look at the Nature article. It was a bit too steep for me. I wasn't going to attempt it. It's rather large. But I think one of the things that, as you pointed out, they didn't mention earlier songs. One of the things that's happened about songwriting lyrics is, first of all, originally they were written by professional lyricists. An artist didn't write their own songs. So there were certain rules that professional lyricists worked by. Eventually, through the 60s, and 70s, as artists began writing their own songs, they began to take liberties. They said, I can write whatever I want to write about. So it doesn't have to be happy, candy-coated pop. It can be a sad song, or it can be an angry song, or it can be all of these emotions that I want to talk about, not necessarily what Tin Pan Alley wants to talk about. So I think that accounts for the divergence of emotion that maybe they're detecting. It's because people are writing about more emotions now than they used to. You don't need to write a song about wanting to get married in the chapel nowadays in order to have a hit. You can write a song about being sad or angry.
Yeah, I guess. So, you know, there are famous breakup albums and there are songs historically that are sad songs, but I'm not sure that it's, you'd have to really dig into the data. I know that there's a lot of angry rap music. There's a lot of angry heavy metal, or at least they're cosplaying angry, right? They might not actually be angry. So there's a lot of anger in a lot of music, and country music, you know, that can sometimes be like that. But they claim to have studied 350,000 songs. I just don't see, it doesn't seem that you can really come to this sort of conclusion. How did they choose the songs that they studied, right? Did they choose the most popular songs? It's really not clear. You'd have to dig into the data. I don't know if they actually presented. What I find interesting is that, first of all, someone would do this and take the time to do this. And there are, I don't know, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 co-authors of the paper.
If you look at the Nature article, you'll find out that they reference dozens of other research data that have been going on. This is a popular research topic, measuring things about pop music, the beats, the word counts, all of these things, measuring the emotion of them. It's a fairly sizable group of people researching this stuff. So they're all relying on each other's data. And so maybe it's a circle jerk. I don't know. But I mean, it certainly does seem some of their conclusions are understandable anyway. At least they're understandable.
Well, one example is a paper cited a functional MRI study of happy and sad emotions in music with and without lyrics. No, but there could be some music therapy could get, could benefit from this. And I don't know, supermarkets. Like, how do people react when they hear certain types of songs? Maybe this is the kind of data that the companies like Muzak or whatever replace them and provide set lists for supermarkets might use.
I saw an article recently, or at least the headline of an article, that talked about, is a song happy? It depends what culture you live in. And I know for a fact that there are some Eastern European types of music that it's not the key that it's in. It's not the major or the minor. It's the speed at which you play it. That makes it happier if it's faster. So it can be in a minor key, but if it's fast, it's happy. So that's a different kind of thing than we have in Western culture where, well, no, it has to, if it's in a minor key, it's sad. If it's in a major key, it's happy. They don't hear it that way. That's which I think is fascinating. I wish I didn't hear it that way, but that's the way it works.
I don't think I hear it that way. I was listening to Bach's St. Matthew Passion last night, and some of it's in minor and some of it's in major. And it's about the guy being killed and, then re-arising. We're recording this on April 1st, so yesterday was Easter Sunday, and I figured, oh, got to listen to the Passion. I don't know that major and minor are that important. One of the things about Eastern European countries is they may have more modes than Western music does, which have their own emotional weight to them. And we can't really judge that because it is a contextual thing. You've grown up in a society listening to this sort of music, and you naturally know how it feels. For instance, I watched Poor Things yesterday, the movie with Emma Stone. Interesting movie. There was one scene where she's in Portugal, and there's someone with a guitar up on a balcony singing Fado, which is the melancholic Portuguese type of music. And it's melancholic, but is it just that it's a minor key or is it a mode? I really wasn't paying attention, but I have a feeling that it could be a mode as well, adding to the minor key. Blues is generally major key, but what makes the blues is those sevenths and those fourths, which kind of are modal.
But there's this whole da-da-da-da-da. You know, I mean, that's what heavy metal is based on. You know, that you play the 1, the 3, and the 4, or the minor third. Smoke on the Water, bah, bah, bah. You know, that's got that feel.
Yeah.
It's not happy, but it's not, it's not sad either, but it's not happy.
It's the blues.
Yeah, it's the blues, yeah. Right, exactly.
But also remember, with the blues, there is this context that when you hear that da-da-da-da-da, or da-da-da-da-da, you know what's coming. When you hear the intro, the first couple of bars of the intro, you know what to expect, and that colors your view of the rest of the song.
I forgot what they said about blues music being happy or sad. I don't remember. But they did stick to some genres. I think blues was one of them, wasn't it?
They talk about blues, and at one point they say that blues and funk are highly repetitive compared to other genres. And it's true that blues, it's like, you could have a blues song that's like, my daddy's dead, my daddy's dead, my daddy's gone away, my daddy's dead.
No, it's like, I woke up this morning, my baby was gone. I woke up this morning, my baby was gone. Well, what are you going to do now? Well, I guess I'm going to leave because everything is done. You know, I mean, it's your basic. My father used to call the blues music that I listened to, I woke up this morning music, because it seemed like all of the songs had, you know, I woke up this morning in it. Which probably true, about 80% of them did. Yeah, so I thought that was interesting that they picked on these categories of music, which of course funk is repetitive. We got the funk, gotta have that funk. I mean, it's just you're just funking around with the same lyrics over and over and over again. So,
and the lyrics are totally unimportant,
right? Exactly, it's the syncopation of the lyrics, just like rap and hip hop, where you know it's the syncopation of what they're saying. So,
rap lyrics are much more diverse. They're not repetitive. Rap lyrics are totally creative.
And I think, so that's another thing where you're going to see more emotion, and that's another thing where you're going to see more anger than you would normally see.
But that's also the historical context of rap, where you have all these angry songs and gangster rap and diss songs and breakup songs and feuds and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And frankly, the whole bitches and hoes thing is a bit... You know, it's not very cool to be talking about people like that.
But, you know, it's no different than like cowboy music or country and western music where, you know, people talk about, you know, riding the range and stuff like that. It's the same sort of mythology.
No, I'm just talking about what it says about the treatment of women.
Oh.
Right? The misogynistic.
Oh, yeah. So, well, yes. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. But I mean, as far as like creating a mythology, that's not a big deal.
Going back to repetition, I've been listening to Jorma Kaukonen's Qua recently a couple of times, and there's one song, and I didn't know who wrote the song. Another man done gone. Another man done gone. Another man done gone. Down on the county farm, another man done gone. And I was thinking this is like Blind Lemon Jefferson or someone. It's Johnny Cash.
Well, yeah. Well, it's a work song. It's a prison song, you know? It's that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So I that's what I've always thought. It just keeps the rhythm of the work going.
Yeah.
The number of different words used in lyrics has shrunk, especially when it comes to rock and rap. Had we mentioned that?
No.
Not really, but rock and rap is sort of what... It seems like these are the two genres, really, that are getting the most heat for being dumb, you know? And I think it's because there's just a wider array. There's people writing the words... are writing about more different things rather than, you know, what they were writing before, rather than what pop songs were about before.
Yeah, if you think as they were all love songs, basically, until, what, the 60s, and then it started being about tripping, and then the 70s, and you came singer-songwriters, and everything. Well, 60s with Dylan, of course, and then all the singer-songwriters, and people were writing. See, there's still a lot of love songs and singer-songwriter things, but look at something like Hotel California. That is extremely sophisticated lyrically. It's not a love song. It's actually a post-apocalyptic zombie apocalypse song or something like that. You know, you check into Hotel California, you can't leave. And I think... there's more lyrical flexibility. I mean, there's more lyrical flexibility once you got past 3 minutes in the song, right? You had to fill the space with more. So you couldn't just have Another Man Done Gone for six verses. That's not interesting enough. But could it just be that people are exposed to so much stuff that songs have to fight for interest, and not just musically, but lyrically as well?
Well, one of the things that's pointed out is that the streaming services have put constraints on how music is built, just the way every technology kind of has. You know, 7-inch singles could only be so long, so they're only like 2.5-3 minutes long. Albums can only be so long and have so many songs on them. And so, it's the same with CDs, and now we get into streaming. But now the streaming has put constraints on it, and that is, in general... a song has to be played for about 30 seconds before it can make any money.
Yeah.
So it's now the job of the producer to make the first 30 seconds the most interesting. And then after that, well, whatever. You know, you can be, well, whatever, as long as we've, you know, as long as if we're going to spend any resources on anything, it's got to be on that first 30 seconds because that's where the payoff's going to be.
Yeah. And some other study that we recently saw, I don't know if we talked about it, showed that intros to songs have gotten shorter because you could have a 30-second intro before the song really started back in the day. Think of Stairway to Heaven. And you can't do that now because people will skip if the song doesn't grab them right away.
Right. And that, and presumably what grabbing means is you got to get to the hook of the song, whether that's a chorus or a riff or a dance beat or whatever it is. Apparently, this has got to be introduced in the first 30 seconds. That's not a lot of time, really. I mean, if you think about singles back in the 60s, that's probably about what they would do, right? A song would have to grab you really fast because there were so many of them.
Yeah.
But nowadays, it's different because they don't want the song necessarily... You're not going to go out and buy the record.
Right. It's repeatability that they want. They want to get you to like the song enough to listen to it over and over and over.
Right.
That's the big thing. And I think a lot of people don't even do that. What they do is on Spotify, they just go to whatever the Spotify playlists are that's playing the favorite songs, which is like top 40 or top 100 radio.
That's an interesting theory. But over the weekend, I don't know how many times I saw tweeted, I have this new Beyonce album on repeat all day. So it's like, you know, it's...
Yeah, but these are rare. Taylor Swift, Beyonce.
Absolutely.
There's a few artists that can get that. But I think in the broader scheme of things, there's a blip for each one of these artists. And after that, it goes back to the same playlist.
Right.
Not everyone likes Beyonce. Not everyone likes Taylor Swift. And so they're just going to listen to that one Spotify playlist or Apple Music 5 playlist, you know, Friends Mix, What's New, and Discovery, whatever they're calling them. And most people aren't going to even seek out songs or albums anymore because it's too much work.
I know. It's too bad because that's the only way I can enjoy music is by hearing the full album. I really like to hear a collection of songs. It doesn't have to be conceptual. It can just be a packet of songs, but... If it says something about the artist at a particular time, I like that.
There's a context in an album.
Yeah, right,
there's a reason that these songs are all together. That this one's before that one.
There's actually another irritating thing that's happening lately, and that is a band will release an album. Well, no, they won't. They release two songs from it, and then a month later they'll release two more songs, and then a month later another song, and it goes on and on and on, and then it totally ruins the idea of an album. I mean, eventually, if you wait 9 months, a year, you can get the full album and experience it that way. But a number of the records that I've been listening to, a lot of newer music that I've been listening to, does that quite frequently. Maybe it's a good idea. I mean, it's fine. I have to keep going back to the album in my Apple Music to see if they've released any more tracks. It's kind of annoying, but I don't mind it that much. Because if that's the way it is, that's the way it is. What are you going to do? But it does ruin the conception.
It's like when bands would release a couple singles before the album came out. So you'd hear a couple of hits and a couple of B-sides, although you might not have heard the B-sides on the radio, and then the album comes out and you've got the whole package.
Right.
But yeah, it is kind of annoying. And now it's the whole, you pre-add albums to your streaming thing.
Yeah.
It's like with pre-add. Who came up with that idea?
I don't know.
It's like, why don't you just reserve it or something?
Yeah,
right?
That's
like
a good
reserve
word.
Reserve a book at the library. Yeah.
I like that word. That's good.
Yeah. Okay, should we do next tracks?
Sure.
I'm going to talk about a next track that I have not listened to yet. So our friend Tim O'Andrus, who's been on the show many times, has released a new album on Nonesuch, and it's called The Blind Bannister. The Guardian reviewed it with 4 stars, calling it original, arresting, and eclectic. Tim O is... to quote The Guardian, like a number of U.S. composers of the 30-something generation, he takes the minimalism of John Adams and Philip Glass as the starting point for his eclectic musical language. Quite impressive. There's 2 piano concertos. One is called The Blind Bannister, and the other is called Upstate Obscura. I like his names. He's got more interesting names than a lot of contemporary people. And then there's, one other piece called Colorful History. Again, I haven't listened to it yet because... Well, sorry, Timbo, I didn't get around to it. I know it came out a few days ago. The solo piece, Colorful History, is a chaconne of increasing complexity, according to The Guardian. And The Guardian seems to be quite happy about it. We're going to listen to it soon. I hope Timbo's going to make some videos. I didn't check on his website if he's got some of these living room videos of any of this. I know he's been touring the U.S., performing with a whole bunch of different orchestras. He recently did his Carnegie Hall debut solo recital, which was sold out. So if you're looking for some good classical music in the sense of classical, not classical, Tim O'Andrus, The Blind Bannister. Doug, what have you got?
I'm going to recommend an entire genre. This is a first, I think, for us. The genre is something that I just stumbled over recently called UK Americana. And it's in conjunction with the actual record that I'm going to listen to by a band called The Hanging Stars. And their record is called On a Golden Shore. And they play, well, Americana, but they're British. And for years, I've been seeing a lot of these British bands who play Americana called country, which is really weird because they're not. It's not country music or Nashville music or anything like that. So I'm glad somebody decided to call it UK Americana because we've always had UK Americana. Like Exile on Main Street is UK Americana. Muswell Hillbillies by the Kinks is UK Americana. A lot of early Rod Stewart is UK Americana. He was doing like this folk music. Rod Stewart has a folk history in England. He was with a group called Steam Packet, and they used to do blues and folk music. So there's always been this British element who have been infatuated with American country music and blues music and folk music. But I'm glad now that they've finally got a category, a genre all their own. UK Americana. That's just a great, I love the idea of it because it definitely talks about the UK will resynthesize that American sound like they always do and make it better. Like they plane the dumb edges off of the American music and make it, I think, a lot better. So anyway, if you can't listen to every record that's described by UK Americana, then at least listen to The Hanging Stars on a Golden Shore. That's a really fine record. This was episode number 279 of The Next Track. Thank you for listening. You can start or join a conversation in the comment section of this episode's show page at our website. And you'll also find links to some of the things we talked about in the show notes for this episode. Just visit thenexttrack.com. We also hope you'll support The Next Track by making a regular donation via Patreon. We're ad-free and self-sustaining, so we depend on the listener support of our Patreon patrons to keep us going. Visit patreon.com/thenexttrack. Thank you. I'm Doug Adams, and for Kirk McElhern, thanks again. We'll talk to you next time.